보리 도착하여가 보다만에 볼따라마세 문강아 발로해당이 볼들도셔가 행해 바사가만일다 얼렁아 치르갱아 발로해당이 하다도셔 하야허가 다랴만일다 한테나모체 문강아 발로해당 하르다셔가 행해 바사가만일다 얼렁아 치르갱아 발로해당이
latest offensive in the east. It was losing badly. Soldiers were being encircled. It was really bad news. And all of a sudden, we have this tragedy of killing civilians on this flight. And this puts the Ukraine back on the front page. It competes with Gaza. A lot of sympathy, quote unquote, for the Kiev regime. I mean, this is good timing in a way for the coup regime achieving too many since February.
Well, the regime did achieve significant successes because Ukrainian oligarchs created a coalition with declared fascists, and through the coup, these fascists took control over the armed forces and police of the Ukrainian state with the resources of 44 million people. And in the last 2 months, the Kiev regime was able to tighten its noose around the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics, and the latest news are that another two towns in the north of the Donetsk People's Republic are now occupied by the Kiev regime as of last night. The other thing besides that is that what we have currently, the timing was very suspicious and very convenient and very good news for the Kiev regime on the propaganda PR media level and also at the political level, because the Kiev regime, the oligarchs and the fascists are now generating a good deal of goodwill and sympathies toward their cause, and it also allows them to cast people who rose against the junta, against the fascists, as terrorists, which was the line or the way in which the Kiev regime was casting them from the very beginning. And so now the Kiev regime tries to present itself as someone who
into the question of the way this is being spun in media. You can take, this is the narrative, and you can take the same story and you can spin it 100 different ways. There are hundreds and hundreds of people, perhaps thousands, who have been killed in bombing raids. And the point is that if the plane was brought back down by the Ukrainian resistance, by the rebels, they were trying to protect themselves from aerial bombardment by the Kyiv regime. I do not know who brought down the plane, but the reason they were shooting into the someone was shooting into the sky was not for fireworks. They were doing it for an attempt at self-protection. Now, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have died in artillery strikes, who have died in aerial bombardment in eastern Ukraine, and those civilians are just as dead as the people who were on the plane. The people on the plane deserve all of our sympathy, but then so do the people on the ground, and we don't get any pretty pictures of just married couples and babies who were killed by the massive onslaught in eastern Ukraine. So apparently they're good dead and they're bad dead, and we only get to see the dead that our media wish for us to see.
Okay, Eric in New York, one of the things that I'm so troubled about this whole story is that it's getting down, we're getting to the brink here. I mean, the rhetoric coming out of Washington and watching the hysterics, and you pointed out where you are, what's the next step? I mean, war? Because one thing that seems to me is it's very misunderstood is that they think they can intimidate Vladimir Putin back down. That's not going to happen here. And this is what makes it so very dangerous. And I worry when I listen to Western media, the drumbeat to war, we all remember it in 2003, it's happening again.
Absolutely, and it's happening in a far more dangerous situation, in a far more dangerous equation, of course. I mean, it's self-evident why it's so dangerous. And I would return to your question of what next and sort of place this MH17 incident into a broader narrative that is being spun, and that is the narrative of Russian aggression and how this is going to translate. It'll translate in a number of ways. One of the ways that it's happened, and I recently wrote a column about this, the United States and certain factions within the political establishment in the United States are trying to legislate anti-Russian sentiments, are trying to legislate through the Congress various ways that the United States is going to be able to aggressively posture in a belligerent fashion against Russia. The so-called Russian Aggression Prevention Act of 2014, sponsored by Senator Bob Corker and co-sponsored by John McCain and a slew of other neo cons. They have this bill. It is now in committee in the U.S. Senate talking about things like permanently basing U.S. military forces in NATO countries such as Poland, in Romania, in other places, talking about providing not only military support, but financial support, political and diplomatic support to Ukraine and to a country that is willing to have any kind of a confrontation with Russia. Of course, we know Georgia, we know this is in Eastern Europe where the United States is operating. Now, think about what that means, the Russian Aggression Prevention Act. This means that the United States will have legislation, a law, actually creates a war or darn near a state of war. Now, it is almost unthinkable, and yet this is the reality, and this is what it seems in the United States that not only surrounding this particular incident, the entire in Ukraine, suspicion is it is because the regime change from the very never went as the United States. The United States and bumbled since February 21st through this entire episode. They're trying to make up for it.
Yeah, Vladimir in Cleveland, it's a very interesting theory, trying to make up for it, because the myth of Russian expansionism, the myth of Russian aggression, it's all a myth, but you'll never find that in Western media, ever.
We are dealing here with a very mechanism of projection used by the White House and by the media, because we have reached a point now where so-called NATO expansion is becoming more and more like NATO aggression.
Aggressive expansion to a bill which Eric mentioned, indeed, this is serious stuff. Russia Aggression Prevention Act is basically legislating a state of war with Russia, and now the tragedy with MH17 is trying to sell this very idea as a new global product to So it's a very serious effect, and right when the tragedy happened, the Kiev regime asked for several things. For direct presence of NATO troops in Ukraine, then in the last few days, Poroshenko
buying for a status similar to to the status of Israel or Japan with respect to NATO and the US, which would turn Ukraine into a significant ally of NATO, officially and for all practical purposes. So what we are now seeing is not just rhetoric and campaign, yes, that's bad enough. What we see is actually an escalation, a very dangerous escalation of the war and the conflict with clearly anti-Russian direction, ambitions and goals.
Okay, Eric in Moscow, I can tell you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think we need to get hysterical about this. The war used to be carried out with fighter planes and tanks. It no longer is, for the very simple reason that the war would last about 15 minutes. There is not going to be a ground war between Russia and NATO.
There is a lot of political posturing. A lot of the things which are included in this legislation are already, the stuff they're already doing or they're trying to do, and which they cannot do without Europe coming along. And Europe does not need an escalation of hostilities, at least the senior European countries. I think what is much more significant here are the financial measures which are being contemplated, certainly which have been enacted by the Americans. That the European Union today did precisely nothing on the sanctions front. The entire thing was a damn squib. Maybe they're trying to pressure the French to not sell the second Mistral cruiser, and the French are resisting. This is basically, they're looking for a fig leaf to please their masters in Washington, and the fig leaf is going to be pretty small. Now, what is very significant is I have just done a major Russian banking conference in St. Petersburg, and we had quite a few Chinese speakers. Most of the Chinese banks were involved. And in a way, the current crisis is a challenge, it is a threat to Russia, but it is also a fantastic opportunity. Because if Russia wants to have an independent foreign policy and to protect its own interest, it must render itself independent of the threat of economic blackmail from countries in the dollar bloc. And talking about isolating Russia is laughable.
Okay,
Russia
shares we're almost out of time here, Erica. I have to go to Erica in New York. Erica, I agree with your last comment, is that, you know, the U.S. State Department, particularly Victoria Nuland, has stumbled all the way through this crisis. What's going to stop them from stumbling?
Well, the only thing that's going to stop them is the political calculation that it's a no-win situation for them. And unfortunately, as it stands right now, they haven't come to that realization. And I think that there's got to be a political price for them to pay. And to some degree, I think Obama and the Democrats are going to pay a price for this, unfortunately, in the wrong sort of way, because right-wing Republicans will say that they were weak and not aggressive enough, which is complete absurdity. Yeah. And so, unfortunately, I think that as we go into 2014 midterm elections and then 2016 presidential elections, there will be a fallout for U.S. policy, for Obama administration policy in Eastern Europe.
All righty, gentlemen. I wish we had more time, but we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Cleveland, New York, and here in Moscow. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
Believe that they will not.
I don't disagree with that.
I love the I will say the monster.
Choose the news that concerns you. Choose the opinions that invigorate your mind. Choose the stories that impact your life. Choose the access to your RT. Dramas that can't be ignored. Stories others refuse to notice. Faces changing the world right now. A full picture of today's news. Live, on demand, from around the globe. Rockley.tv.
First bodies of those killed on Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 have returned here to the Netherlands amid a solemn ceremony.
US intelligence says there's no direct link between Russia and the downing of a Malaysia Air flight, claiming it was downed by anti-Kiev fighters, but fails to provide any hard evidence. A British reporter working for RT in eastern Ukraine goes missing in Donetsk. It's suggested he's been held captive by the Ukrainian security service. And in other news,
a strong possibility that international humanitarian law has been violated.
The UN condemns the Israeli offensive in Gaza, saying it could amount to war crimes as it emerges one Palestinian child's been killed every hour during the 2 days of the ground operation so far. Hello and a very good evening to you. If you just joined us, my name's Kevin Owen. You're watching RT International. First, the first bodies recovered from the crash site of flight MH17 have arrived in the Netherlands. They were brought on two transport planes from the Ukrainian city of Kharkov. Paul Scott spoke to RT's Roman Kostrov at the scene of the tragedy, but first heard from Peter Oliver as the victims were brought to Eindhoven.
Well, two transport planes arrived here at Eindhoven Air Force Base, one from the Dutch Air Force, one from the Australian Air Force. They're operating in unison in what they're calling a air bridge mission, where they're to make sure that enough equipment and investigators get into Ukraine and to make sure that all of the bodies of those who died on Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 are brought here to the Netherlands. What we did see, though, is just before the coffin started to be unloaded, a bugler played the last post on the bugle, followed by a minute's silence that, as you would imagine, was impeccably observed. Now, it's understood from talking to airport officials here that around 1,000 relatives of those who died on board that flight are here in attendance, also in attendance dignitaries from the Australian government. The Australian ambassador to the Netherlands is here also. King Willem Alexander of the Netherlands and Queen Maxima, and also as well the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte. Once those bodies are unloaded, they're going into funeral cars and are being driven to a military base near to the city of Hilversum. Now, that military base is the headquarters of the Dutch medical training for the army. Now, that's a facility that can handle such a large amount of bodies and can try and go about initiating the identification process. We understand that will be a very long process. It will be done with the help of the Netherlands Forensic Institute, the NFI, regarded as one of the finest forensic laboratories anywhere in the world. They'll be helping with the ID process, which could take quite a long time. But it's been a very solemn day here in the Netherlands, a day of national mourning, flags across the country at half mast. We did see a very solemn service take place here.
From Peter in Eindhoven to Roman in Ukraine. You're there, Roman. Still more than 100 victims in that site as well. How is the investigation progressing?
That's right. We are here at the crash site of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. And according to the monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, there are still body fragments scattered here in the 20-kilometer radius of the crash site. Not all of them had been recovered. The OSC had been here on the ground starting from the second day after the crash, and Malaysian aviation experts have also arrived here 5 days after the crash, and that's when the investigation commenced. All the sides involved in this investigation, including the monitors, expressed satisfaction with the level of access that they got here, with the level of security, and Malaysian experts expressed a gratitude in that regard as well. Meanwhile, Malaysian Prime Minister said he is not about to blame anybody for the crash of this Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 until concrete evidence is there. So he's waiting for the investigation to commence. Investigation had started, but it's a long way from finishing. Meanwhile, the black boxes that were recovered from this area are now in possession of UK authorities, and perhaps they will be able to shed some light as to what happened to MH17.
It's hoped answers to what happened to flight MH17 will be found in the in-flight data recorders, which have now been delivered to the UK for analysis. Aviation security expert Desmond Ross told us what light they may shed on the cause of what went so terribly wrong.
The flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder are the two boxes we're referring to. The cockpit voice recorder, as the name suggests, will tell us what was said, what noises were heard, everything that occurred in the cockpit prior to the accident. That can be very useful in those last moments of MH17. It could even record the sound of the explosion. It will certainly record the sound of warning bells, gongs, and any comments made by the pilots. The other one, the flight data recorder, specifically records the parameters of the aircraft, its operating characteristics at that time. I would not expect there to be anything unusual on that flight data recorder up until the moment of the explosion. That information should all be stored on the recorders. So long as there's been no tampering and no interference with them, they should be completely able to give us that information. I don't think it will take terribly long. The cockpit voice recorder will be quicker. But the flight data recorder requires specialized equipment, which is why it's gone to England, actually. There's only about half a dozen specialized laboratories in the world where this can be done. I'm sure it will be a very painstaking examination to determine precisely what happened in the last moments, seconds of MH17's flight. It could take weeks.
The official investigation into the MH17 tragedy is only in the initial phase now, but some US and European news outlets already claim to know what exactly happened, using the internet's unverified, unproven theories which appeared online very soon after the crash. They made Moscow the culprit. Gani Chichikan reports.
The media coverage in the West has been largely slanted against Russia. Public opinion, of course, responds to that kind of coverage.
Public sentiment is that Russia's probably involved, and if involved, they're probably going to cover it up. That's where the public sentiment is in the CNN poll.
The American people got it right in terms of who's to blame here, folks. 51% say Russia's indirectly involved.
Clearly the stakes are high. Whoever shoulders the blame for this atrocity is going to be the target of global anger. And right now it looks like it's Russia's fault, because it's Russia's fault.
It's quite clearly the latest twist in this propaganda war. The Russians, through their ambassador here in Kuala Lumpur, presenting their version of events to the Malaysian media.
There have also been attempts to discredit Russian sources of information. CNN put out a breakdown of what it called Russia's propaganda. The first item on the list is this. It says, the Russian take. Passengers were already dead when put aboard the MH17. But when you follow the link on this page, it has an article in Russian which reviews all the apparently quote-unquote fake versions and conspiracy theories that are out there. That's what the article says, specifically about the theory that the bodies were dead before the crash. It says literally. Then there is information which is simply impossible to believe. CNN presents it and calls it the Russian take. It is not the Russian take. In the same breakdown, right after this dead bodies theory, CNN puts Russian defense officials showing evidence that Ukraine had the capability to shoot down the plane. Moscow is not saying Ukraine did it, it's showing evidence that it had the capability to do it, contrary to what Kyiv is now saying. That claim is brushed off as propaganda. Information is now politically charged on all airwaves. It seems many journalists have already handed down their verdict. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chagan, RT.
Seems so. Well, accusations in the media against Moscow over the downing of MH17 are being amplified by world leaders. American journalist Robert Parris is jumping to conclusions to score political goals, though pays little respect to those killed.
My concern has been that there's been a rush to judgment, that the way such terrible events should be treated is to have a serious investigation and then reach conclusions and hold people accountable, whoever it was. But the first step should be to have a serious investigation which shows respect for those who were killed. And what was the need to reach conclusions before the investigation was undertaken? It was really unseemly on the part of much of the mainstream U.S. press, and frankly, the Obama administration. Secretary of State Kerry was on the talk shows over the weekend, essentially pointing the finger and saying he knows, we know, and making a case. The case should come after the evidence is assembled and evaluated by professionals, by serious people, not rushed out there as a way to make a point.
U.S. intelligence says there's no direct link connecting Russia to the Malaysian plane crash in eastern Ukraine. Washington does claim, though, that Moscow created the conditions that led to the tragedy. Presenting their evidence at an intel briefing, officials say anti-government forces are most likely responsible for downing that plane by mistake. Backing their proof are photos and videos posted on social networks that they can't verify. Anastasia Cherkiner explains more on that side of the story.
U.S. intelligence officials speaking on conditions of anonymity, really under a thick veil of secrecy, are coming out and saying that they have absolutely no evidence and no proof showing any kind of involvement on behalf of the Russian government when it comes to this tragedy. Certainly, this is something that's a very big development in this story, because this does not really fit the narrative that the U.S. has been pushing in this whole ordeal, as of course meanwhile, certainly the investigation is really just beginning to take off. Importantly, we've heard from one U.S. Intelligence official say, we don't know a name, we don't know a rank, and we're not even 100% sure of a nationality. This, keeping this in mind, they are continuing to say that it's likely this was a mistake, shoot down conducted by the anti-Kyiv fighters on the ground in eastern Ukraine. But it looks like because of so much secrecy and these reports really are interpreted differently, certainly in U.S. media, we're seeing journalists going so far as to say that they have don't even have any certainty at all in terms of this being specifically the anti-Kyiv fighters. We know that these U.S. intelligence officials are saying that they are basing these claims on social media and posts made by the Ukrainian government, and that's certainly not a first when it comes to the Ukrainian crisis. On Monday, Russia's defense ministry has said also that they have proof that there was another plane in the air next to the Malaysian Airlines flight before it was shot down. They believe that this plane resembled a Ukrainian military jet, and they have been demanding comments or an explanation from Kyiv, and Kyiv, of course, thus far has denied this. We also do know that Russia's defense ministry has also said
said that they have images of Ukrainian missile systems within the zone of the crash.
Our correspondent in New York. So, the U.S. maintains that Russia is responsible for creating the conditions for the crash, admitting, though, that that's partly based on social media posts. Whatever hard evidence it says it's got, it's kept concealed, and the possible reasons for this come up in today's crosstalk.
The Americans have extraordinarily good signal intelligence. They are spying on the entire world. They know what you and I had for breakfast today. It defies belief to imagine that they did not have spy satellites over the place where the events occurred. Now, what they're saying, what Mr. Kerry seemed to be saying was, oh, we have excellent evidence, much better than the Russians, but he won't say what it is. If they have this evidence, and it was in their favor, I would imagine it would be all over the pages of the New York Post right now. Oddly, it's just, believe me, we have a mountain of evidence. Well, they had a mountain of evidence on the Iraqi WMD, too. They'd made it up.
Anti-Kiev forces say they've downed two fighter jets in eastern Ukraine near the site of the MH17 disaster. Earlier, a ceasefire had been declared by the country's leader in an area spanning a 40-kilometer radius around the crash site to try to ensure the safety of those air crash investigators. Ukraine security service was quick to accuse Russia of firing the rockets from its territory. Meantime, RT's lost contact with correspondent Graham Phillips, who's apparently disappeared in East Ukraine, along with the journalist for the country's ANA news channel. Moscow's demanded that the journalist be released immediately. Let's try and get laced on this. Irina Galushka's across this story for us tonight. Hi, Irina. What news is there of Graham tonight, then?
Well, there is no news about Graham Phillips whatsoever as of now, but we spoke to a fellow journalist from the ANA News channel who strongly suspects that both his colleague and Graham have been apprehended by Ukraine's security services.
Our last contact was at 11 p.m. local time. Four people, including Graham, a reporter and two other men, went missing around Donetsk airport. We have information they're being held captive by the Ukrainian security service. That's according to anti-government forces. We can't verify this at the moment.
Now, Kyiv denies detaining the journalists or that they ever did. However, in May, Graham was detained by security services of Ukraine for alleged espionage links. He was questioned for about 36 hours and released. On Tuesday evening, he has informed RT that he was planning to go to the area of Donetsk airport. Now, we have warned him that it's extremely dangerous. That was the scene of some of the most intense fighting over the past several days. Nevertheless, Graham said that he's going to go. He sent a text message overnight saying that he has arrived there shortly, and that was the last that anybody has ever heard from him at RT. However, we did speak to one person, one journalist who has asked that he remains unnamed, who was with Graham when they were heading to the airport.
We all went to the airport together. Some 250 meters away, we turned back because we emerged from the trees into an area of open space, like a field. We felt we could be easy targets, so we decided to go back to where we left our car. We warned Graham it could be dangerous, but he and another reporter still decided to proceed. They crossed that field several times. I think they could have been ambushed. When we were back at our car, we called Graham phone, but another guy answered. Apparently, it was that other reporter. He talked very quietly. We asked him where Graham was. He said he was surrounded by the Ukrainian army and that they've got Graham. He asked us to get him out of there.
Now, Moscow has already demanded that journalists be released immediately. A statement from Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says that this is yet another pointed provocation which exemplifies the relation of the Ukrainian officials towards independent international journalists who are not sticking with the information that Kyiv officials are trying to feed to the rest of the world. RT has also contacted the Foreign Office, who said that there are been criticized for so far saying that it will honor its existing contracts to supply Russia with two Mistral helicopter carriers. David Cameron has criticized the move. He has said that it would be unthinkable to honor such a contract if Britain were in France's shoes. And we've heard of an irritated response from across the channel. The French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, is reported to have said that Britain needs to clean up its own backyard before it blasts France for continuing with the sale of those helicopter carriers. Now, you get the sense that he's alluding to the numerous Russian oligarchs that live in the UK, Russians that pay a lot of money to the UK taxman. And just today, a parliamentary inquiry revealed that Britain itself has over 200 export licenses for military equipment worth over £132 million. So you get the sense that Paris could be feeling as though they've been picked on a little bit unfairly. These helicopter carrier contracts are worth a lot of money for them. They provide a lot of jobs for French people. And emerging from a financial crisis, the business isn't something that the French are prepared to part with too lightly, especially if they don't feel like their European allies are sacrificing business interests themselves.
I'm Kevin Owen. Thanks for being with RT International. We appreciate your company. We know you've got a lot of choice. Now, coming up after this break, more world news, including a damning report on children's rights in Palestine. Just ahead.
I'm Abby Martin. The stories we cover here, you're not going to hear anywhere else.
Another big story that mainstream headlines seem to have.
There's a reason they don't want you to know.
Not even the report detailing the reason.
So at the moment, I think all the blame is on Boko Haram, because the Islamic cleric is very critical, and the opposition leader himself has come out and spoken against the violence perpetrated by Boko Haram. It will not be surprising if they are the ones who launched these two attacks on these prominent people.
Mansour Lehman in Abuja. Let's turn to something a little bit different now. And writing novels for a living doesn't always pay the bills. Of course, little-known authors can get a huge boost, even from being on the shortlist for big literary awards. One of the biggest of those is The Man Booker, and the initial long list for this year's award has just been published. For the first time, it includes US writers, which has upset quite a few in the literary community. Our arts reporter Vincent Dowd is here. Vincent, why are they including American writers?
Okay, there are kind of two reasons. One is long-term, which I think is valid, that the world is becoming a smaller place, and we all see what everybody else is reading and everything is online. And to exclude, as the old rules virtually did, just one nation, the USA, and one literary culture, didn't really stand up. You know, to a degree, it reflected what was then called Booker McConnell was interested in 1969 when they started. The other is a cynical reason. There's a new prize starting up called the Folio Prize, which kind of was treading on their toes, which did allow American authors in, The Man Booker was very keen that the Folio should not really steal their thunder.
Dans tes bras, quand une chanson commence au ciel d'été, quand une chanson commence au verbe aimé, à la fête de Saint-Jean pour attendre demain, à la fête de Saint-Jean tu peux prendre ma main, et entre toi et moi, il n'y a qu'un pas, commence, fais-moi danser. Puisque la chanson commence, viens m'embrasser. À la fête de Saint-Jean, lorsque la nuit revient. À la fête de Saint-Jean, le jour n'est pas bien loin. Entre toi et moi, il n'y a plus rien qu'une larme au bord de mes yeux. Entre toi et moi, tu ne la vois pas, puisque tu as fermé les yeux. Nous avons quitté la danse au petit jour. Nous avons quitté la danse pour un amour. Et lorsqu'un amour est né le jour de la Saint-Jean, je sais qu'on peut le garder très longtemps.
Thank you. Greetings, welcome to episode 168 of Active Listening. I'm your host, Stelia. Thank you.
Thank you.
Down.